Hey everyone, I'm Chris Hall, and this is the Downtime Podcast, where we take you inside the world of mountain biking. This week, the Atherton's coach, Nick Grantham, joins us for a chat. But before that, just a couple of quick things. We've now managed to make the podcast meet the podcast loudness standards. Now, what that means is that it should be pretty consistent loudness throughout the episode, so hopefully you won't have to turn the volume up and down, which I know a few people had mentioned was occasionally an issue. And it also means that if you switch from our podcast to another podcast that meets these standards, they should be at the same volume. So it's taken a bit of working out, but hopefully it helps things. For everything podcast related, just head to downtimepodcast.com. You can support the podcast and help us keep bringing you awesome content for free by grabbing yourself a t-shirt from the web store there. Every little helps and we really appreciate it. And it's cool to see people repping the podcast out and about and at races and things like that. So if you fancy a t-shirt, that'd be great. And also, you can subscribe to the podcast. It means you'll get every episode delivered to your device as soon as it's out. It's free. It's pretty easy to do, so all the links you need are there. Also, you'll find the show notes for all of the episodes. So if there's any books we're talking about or any particular links or videos, it should all be on there. All right, let's move on to this week's episode. We've got the Atherton's coach, Nick Grantham, joining us. We're going to talk about how he met the Athertons, go over some tips for injury prevention and injury recovery, talk about some of the key aspects of mountain bike training from his perspective, and also get his really interesting thoughts on the future of mountain bike training and where it's all going. So without further ado, here's Nick Grantham. Nick Grantham, welcome to the Downtime Podcast. Thanks for taking some time out and coming on.
Yeah, thanks for having me on. It's been a while to get here, but I'm looking forward to it.
Yeah. So we got in touch when you just joined the Athertons back. Well, so when was that? Late 2016? Yeah, early 2017.
Yeah, so I met with them in November 2016 and started pretty much the week after I'd met them. At which point you kind of contacted me. I was like, I've not really got anything to talk about, and everyone else has done all the hard work. So I thought we'd wait until there's some sort of good stuff to talk about.
Yeah, good stuff. All right, before we get on to that side of things, give us a little bit of your background. What were you sporty from a young age, and how did the strength and conditioning side of things come into your life?
Yeah, so I think I've always been part of an active family, youngest of three brothers, always took part in various sports, athletics, football, rugby, you know, typical sort of stuff, and being the youngest, always trying to keep up with my older brothers. I then, around about 12, 13, got into taekwondo, and I was quite good at that. I wasn't very good at any of the other sports I tried, athletics and football, but I was pretty good at taekwondo. So I competed in taekwondo for a number of years, and that kind of led me towards sports science. Prior to that, I'd been working in banking and insurance, which were both horrific career pathways for me. But my love of taekwondo and trying to make weight and understand the physical training side of it meant that I picked up one of the first books that I'd read in years on nutrition. And that then led me towards sports science and a sports science degree. So I went back to night school, did my A-levels, and went to university, did a undergraduate and postgraduate degree, and then started working in high performance sport. So very fortunate really that I do a job that's fantastic, that I love.
Yeah. What sort of age were you when you decided to go back to night school?
I was probably about 21, 22, something like that.
Okay.
So laughably, I went to university as a mature student, mature in years, but I think it helped me, because I think a lot of people going to university just kind of went through that pathway of go to school, go to sixth form, go to university, just a natural progression. Whereas I'd seen what it was like to do jobs that were pretty crappy and that you didn't enjoy. So when I went to uni, I made sure I sort of squeezed as much out of that 3-4 year process as possible, because I didn't want to go back to sitting in a little 1 meter square cubicle working 9 to 5.
Yeah, I guess, yeah, it helps for the motivation, I suppose, definitely. Yeah,
definitely.
Yeah. So sports science is your degree then, yeah?
Yeah, so my undergrad was sports science, physiology, exercise physiology, and then I did a postgraduate in exercise and nutrition science.
Okay. And then from there, what was the kind of step into the working world in that side of things?
I was very lucky. I think it was a different time frame then. So strength and conditioning or sports science was only just coming to the fore with UK sport. The British Olympic team had done terribly at the Atlanta Olympics, so there was a big push on funding. And two jobs came up, one for the British Olympic Medical Centre and one for Lily Shaw Sports Injury and Human Performance Centre. I applied for both. Now a friend and colleague, Steve Ingham, applied for both of those jobs. He got the Olympic one and I got the one working with British Gymnastics at Lily Shaw. So, you know, on reflection, to walk into that job, that was probably a job that I would have anticipated having five, 10 years down the line. But there I was straight in working with international gymnasts.
Awesome. Yeah, you've worked with some pretty interesting sports and athletes across your career so far. Can you give us a few kind of examples or highlights from your side of things, just so people get a flavour for what you've done?
Yeah, I think I spent predominantly about 15 years working almost exclusively in Olympic sports. So that covered four Olympic cycles across a wide range of sports, from Paralympic athletes, so wheelchair basketball, I spent a lot of time with those guys, through to British cycling, lots of different sports, really. Spent a period of time directly with England netball. And then more recently, since moving up to Newcastle and going out as an independent consultant, I've worked with the British basketball team going to London 2012. And more recently, spent five seasons with a Premiership football team and are now working with another professional football team. So it kind of spans, we tied it up, Trek and the Atherton's made it 36 sports. So up until that point, it was 35 different sports.
Wow.
So coming to action sports was an exciting opportunity, an area that I've never worked in before. So it was a real challenge. So it's 36 sports now.
Fantastic. Yeah, quite impressive that. So it was mountain biking in your life at all up to the point at which the Atherton's got involved? Had you ridden much in the past?
yeah, very badly. So like, I have no ambition to point my bike down a mountain and go ridiculously quick. That's not sort of in my nature. But certainly got into recreational cross-country riding. Used to take part in the local West Midlands cross-country series and did some of those sorts of 24-hour races, so like 24-hour sleepless and saddle, Cheddar Challenge, those kind of events with teams. But very, very recreational, really. I just enjoy going out into the trails, doing your typical sort of cross-country trail runs with some nice flowy single track, nothing too sketchy. I'm a bit too old and a bit too sensible for that stuff, but I just like getting out there and having a ride. So I was into mountain biking, not particularly downhill, although I did go and actually, without knowing it, watch G and Dan race, and possibly Rach, I'm not sure, but in Bridge North they did about 2006, I think it was, they had a street race, downhill street race, and those guys were racing at that, unbeknownst to me. But we figured that out upon our first meeting.
Interesting.
They'd actually been there.
Yeah, cool. So how did you end up connecting with the Athertons then? How did that happen?
So that came about through Darren Roberts Cohn, who's obviously, you know, he was kind of the grandfather of action sports athletes in the UK and has forged a path. And probably created roles in action sports where there were none. So he spent a significant amount of time with the Athertons in the early days, and that's probably why he's got no hair, because they were probably quite wild in those early years. So he did a lot of the hard work. And when Alan Milway moved on from the team, the Athys reached out to Darren and said, look, you know, we're looking for someone to come in and work with the team. Can you put a list together? And my name featured on that list. And I spoke to Dan Brown, the team manager, on a number of occasions. And then the people that were on that list were called in to meet the riders, answer some technical questions and sort of discuss training approaches. And then over to them to make the decision of who they wanted. So I was very fortunate that they chose me.
Yeah, awesome. So obviously you've got some familiarity with mountain biking before this, but yeah, it effectively a new sport for you to train in, yeah, or train within.
Yeah.
How do you go about assessing a sport and understanding kind of what the physical attributes are that the sport requires and that the riders need to have?
So I think, so people listening to this might think it's a massive disadvantage not knowing the sport. And I think that's one of the issues that sport's probably got. It's quite a young sport. And you know what that means is that most of the people that are either coaches or physical prep coaches have probably come through that sport themselves or action sports. So they can sometimes become a little bit sort of genre blind. They can be a little bit blind to this is what they've always done, so this is how we'll always do it. And well, what could you possibly know having never pointed the bike downhill really quickly and ridden downhill yourself? But for me, having worked across so many different sports, different athletes, it's actually an advantage. I come in with a fresh set of eyes. And I think at the time, that's what the team wanted. They wanted someone to come in and look at it root to branch and say, right, okay, this is where I think we could go. So coming in with no preconceived ideas was the key. What we did was we talked a lot. So, you know, I spoke to all of the riders and the team and the mechanics. I looked at what they could do in the gym. We went out and spent days on the trails watching them ride, which they found a little bit unusual. That why would you want to come out? What are you actually going to get from this? But, you know, you can watch all the head cam footage in the world, but until you see the gradients, the tightness of the tracks, the speeds that they're going, what it's like to go for an uplift, what their nutrition strategies are or are not, you see how the whole team operates. So just spent a lot of time talking and listening, because again, you know, Rach and G have got a significant amount of experience. So who am I to walk in and just go, right, well, I know best. So it's taking the best bits that they've got and then trying to weave in some newer or sort of more innovative approaches or just different approaches, because both at a time in their career where they probably need to change things up a little bit.
Yeah. So what do you think are some of the key physical areas then that are important to the downhill side of mountain biking?
So, yeah, I mean, there's very little research on downhill. There's a few bits. And so immediately you think, well, it's going to be having to put out big power outputs at the start. And the riders do need to put down the power early on, but it's nowhere near as maximal as you think. And I think sometimes riders can fall into two camps. They'll get obsessed with doing conditioning work, so stuff that replicates the 3 to 5 minutes that they're on the bike and it feels like you get the pump and the burn and all those sorts of things. Or they fall into the camp of, you know, let's get massive and let's get super strong and let's look at force production. And, you know, doing either one of those things is, it may work for a short period of time, but you probably need a blend, and you also need to look at what each rider needs. So I think, you know, we probably moved away from the big force production aspect. The guys were strong already, and it was more about getting that power down within split seconds when required on the race run. So more about force application. So the riders need to have a base level of strength. They then need to be able to apply that in a context that's specific to riding. And then it's looking at energy system development. So again, a lot of teams and a lot of riders kind of fall into that, well, let's get loads of hours on the road and let's do lots of road miles to get the baseline CV hit. And that is important. You need an underpinning cardiovascular fitness to support the race weeks and the race weekends and training. But you also need to look at some of that specific work. It's difficult to often get that just purely on the bike because it's such a hazardous aspect. So it's looking at ways in which to make the cardiovascular training targeted off the bike as much as possible. So I spoke to colleague Steve Ingham, who'd worked with Olympic Sports and British Rowing and various guys, to come in and just look at, okay, what's the physiology that we need to change here, and what's right for Rachel would be very different to what G required in terms of the way they race and their physiology. So yeah, we try to drill down and come up with sort of approaches that work for each of those riders.
Okay. And how different was it for those guys compared to what they were used to?
I think there was the cornerstones of the program were the same. I think I probably tried to move them away from some of the, you know, just going for heavier loads all the time. So that force production, so they could lift, you know, and like to lift, and especially G, you know, he's a strong boy, you know, he's in shape. But I felt that actually it's more about the application of that. So with going for increasing loads, you know, if you're starting to get back problems and issues that are happening in the gym that are unrelated to riding, that for me is a problem, you know. So it was trying to give them the strength and the power that they needed in the gym, but without causing any injuries. You know, they get the injuries on the bike, that's hard enough as it is. So I think that was probably a slightly different approach. We looked at the warm-ups and cool down strategies as well. That was one of the key areas that they were interested in. So again, making it specific for both riders. Both want slightly different things from their warm-ups at the bottom and at the top of the mountain. So coming up with individual plans for that was something else that we approached. So really it was taking all the good stuff that they're already doing, and they were doing a lot of good stuff, and just adding some little bits of my stuff into there.
Yeah, and obviously those guys have been doing this sort of stuff for a long time, and I get the impression that, well, I guess with all sports and with athletes, the athlete needs to be in a good mindset. So are those guys pretty heavily involved in structuring what they do with you?
Structure is an interesting word. planned unpredictability is probably the key with not just action sports. You know, action sports get given this label of being really loose and kind of feral athletes. They're no different to a lot of athletes that I work with. You know, they're young and they have lots of different demands on their time. So we've worked through, you know, multiple iterations of what works, from being very structured and then their head will fall off because it's too structured, to going very sort of loose and almost like a menu, and then coming back to almost like a center point saying, well, actually, there's too many decisions for me to make now. So it's trying to strike the balance between, here's a menu of what needs to happen this week or this training block, but you can choose how that then gets implemented. And just trying to come up with sessions and plans that are very flexible, because again, the nature of where we live and where the riders live, they have to take the opportunity to ride when the weather's good. So we may have a week plan, but then if they get 2-3 days of good weather, they're going to go out and hit the downhill runs or get out and do some cross country work. So it's trying to roll and have a fluid program with enough continuity in it that they don't just do random stuff every day, but with some consistent themes throughout.
Okay. And are there certain kind of key metrics or things that you're tracking throughout these programs?
Yeah, I guess the sexy answer would be, yeah, we measure all these sophisticated things. We've done some work with tracking numbers. Again, with these two riders, the approach is a little bit different because they're so experienced. They've got good track records. They've got good record keeping. You know, Rach is meticulous with her. I mean, they're quite long-winded, her notes, but, you know, she can go back and look at previous seasons, what she's lifted, what, you know, lots of comments around it. So we use that a lot, and that's a really valuable metric to go back and see what she did in 2015, 2016. But then I also look at just the numbers on the bar, you know, what's going on in terms of the volume that we're lifting. We do, particularly with G and Rach, actually more so with G, we looked at velocity-based training. So when trying to convince the riders that it's not just about numbers on the bar, it's about how you move that. We use some wearable technology that just gave us an insight into, look, actually, it's the speed of movement that's quick. So rather than being slow and deliberate and strong, you now got to move that quickly. So we've used some of that technology. And then using some simple tools like your Watt bikes, you know, Watt bikes are a great tool just to give you some outputs, either like 6-second efforts or just picking standard training sessions, really. Standard training sessions in the gym and on the Watt bike that, you know, we know what you did this time last season. Where are we at? Where are we at now? So we do measure some things, probably not as much as people would imagine. If I had younger riders, a different team, we probably might take a different approach. But for these guys, you do what works.
So when you talk about the velocity-based side of things, that's the acceleration, the speed at which you're moving the bar.
Yeah, so the bar or the body or the implement that you're working with, so there's a direct relationship between load and speed of movement, and then that actually determines the type of strength qualities that you're developing. I wanted to push the riders more towards their force application and the ability to access their strength very quickly, which is important for downhill. So we just set some parameters of how we want the exercise to be executed, and then the kit measures that and lets us know whether we're on track.
Okay. And it's just so something like a beast sensor, yeah, from a beast, commercially.
Yeah, so we use Push, Beast. There's various ones out there, Gecko. There's quite a few now that you can use, and it basically is just like a bit of an accelerometer that you have in your phone. But it's a simple bit of kit. And I've got the coaching eye, so I know if it looks fast or if it looks slow. But what you need is sometimes the numbers, the metrics to convince the rider or the athlete that what we're doing is the right way to go.
Okay, cool. Yeah, interesting stuff. I haven't heard of many people using that, so something a bit different. You mentioned injuries a bit earlier, and obviously it seems to be a very important part of both G and Rachel's careers. They've both suffered some pretty significant injuries, and I guess that's par for the course. You know, these guys have been at the top of the game pushing hard for a long time, so you're going to get hurt. Since you joined the team, you've probably seen some of the worst of it. So G dislocated his hip at Fort William pretty soon after you guys got started, and then had some issues with a broken wrist, I think, this season.
So you come into a team that's been highly successful. Rakes has never lost, no pressure. I got to watch one win at Lourdes, and then it all started to unravel in a fairly big way, which has its pros and cons. But to dislocate a hip, is you've got to be trying really hard to do that. Interestingly, a week before I was speaking at a conference in Wales for Welsh rugby, and there was a colleague, Jason Laird, who was doing a case study on traumatic hip dislocation with a judo player and his sort of accelerated rehab, and it was fascinating. And I was listening to it, and I spoke to Jason afterwards. I said, "Oh, that's amazing, but fingers crossed, I'll never have to look at anything like that." And literally a week later, I got the phone call from Cone, from Darren Roberts, saying, "G's come off, and it's a big one." And I was on the phone to Jason saying, right, those notes about hip dislocations, I need to have a look at them. So, that was a real challenge. That's a big injury. G was very fortunate, if you can be fortunate dislocating a hip, that the amount of damage that potentially can happen when a hip dislocates is huge. He got away with minimal, not insignificant, but minimal associated sort of injuries. And his grit and determination really meant that he came back way ahead of schedule. I think myself and the medical team, we were looking at coming back for about 4 weeks after. So well, let's have a look what we were looking at. I think we were looking at Monson Anne, and G was adamant that he wanted to come back before then for Lenzerheide. And that was 56 days after his initial injury, and he had surgery in between that. And we're like, you just can't do that. That's not going to happen. G's a grown man. He's a big boy. He can make his own decisions. And his decision was, panned out to be right. If it had gone wrong, it would have probably been the end of his season for him. But he rolled the dice, the nature of those sorts of athletes, and he got away with it. He did send me one video, because there was one movement that we said, if this happens, it's going to be a nightmare. And it was kind of going into a left-hand turn, putting the left leg out. And he said, yeah, it was all going good until this. And he sent me a photo of him taking a big sweep in left, and the leg got caught and whipped back, the exact movement you didn't want. But he got away with it. I think he said the old girl didn't like this too much. But he's a phenomenal athlete to get back on a bike after that. And even this season, to get back up and ride Fort William, that takes a huge set of nuts to do that. So, I'm not sure how he did it. Obviously, a lot of work from myself and Doug Jones, who works at Altius, who's been physio with the team for over a decade, and knows their bodies inside out. But a lot of that work comes down to G. Doing so well, and the same with Rach. Rach has battled back from some significant injuries last season as well.
Yeah, amazing to see the presence of mind when she dislocated her shoulder at Fort William to literally be stood at the side of the track getting someone to put the shoulder back in.
Yeah, I feel sorry for that poor guy. He's having so nervous. I'm pulling as hard as I can. So that was a tough weekend. I'd actually gone up to watch as a spectator with my children, and we'd watched practice and it was great, and we watched qualifying and that was fantastic. And I remember walking in to the pits on the morning on Sunday and seeing Brownie, and you knew immediately that something wasn't right. And I'd been speaking to Darren Roberts the week before, and I said, oh yeah, I'm just going to go up and watch, you know, spectator. Darren went, you'll end up working. I says, I won't. I says, I'm just going to watch. He went, you will end up working. And sure enough, sort of driving back from Fort William, it was on the phone with the kids in the back of the car, organising with Doug, consultant appointments and you know, scans and what have you. So again, for Rach to come back, you know, less than a month, it was 28 days, she came back and raced and came fourth as well, you know. So that was huge. And we then kind of refocused our attention, not on the other World Cup races, although obviously as a competitive animal, she wants to do as well as she can, but it was really, the focus was the World Championships. And going into Cairns, she was in a great place. You know, we'd got her head round the injury, and where she was physically was good, and practice runs were looking sharp. And then obviously the collarbone breaks, and that's another tough one to swallow for her, not being able to defend her title. So yeah, that meant a tough winter for Rachel.
Yeah. What does it take, do you think, for a rider to come back from something like that? I guess there's a couple of key elements. There's the knowledge and the physical care that they get from the team around them, so people like yourself. But there's also a mental aspect. How do those two stack up, you think?
It's huge, you know. I always say to athletes I work with, I'll stand shoulder to shoulder with you. You know, whatever it takes to get you back, we'll do our best to do that. So it's given them the confidence. And I think by that time, you know, I'd worked with Rach and G long enough, even though it was quite a short period of time, we'd had quite an intense summer with their injuries, that there was a level of trust there that we'd formed. And I think, I'd like to think that I'd formed that trust and that bond with Rach pretty quickly over the initial months working with her. And then there's a huge psychological aspect that comes to it, a huge social and emotional and mental aspect that can't be underestimated. And that's probably the bigger part of it, you know, that you will be okay, that this is normal, this is the normal healing process, this is the pain response, this is where we're going to get you to, this is how we're going to get there, how we refocus our attention. There's lots we did. And December last year was pretty dark, and I remember getting Rach a couple of books that I often, well, I say often, that I've given to a couple of athletes I've worked with. So one of them is The Path of the Doer, which is a great book, and it's just about, you know, it's a tough old time trying to achieve anything. And the other one, which you probably thought is a bit random, but I think appealed to Rach, was a Dr. Zeus book, interestingly, which was what's the title of it? Look at how far you've come. So I think that's the title of the book. But a Dr. Zeus book, again, which just talks about it's a dark times, and you know, it actually talks about going out and tackling your mountain, which resonated nicely with Rach. So, mm-hmm. You know, things like that to keep the motivation. Myself and Rach particularly, we have some little phrases that we will sometimes sign off on messages with that just keep the focus of what we're doing and why we're doing it. So little words or a phrase can have a big impact. And even leading into the Worlds this year, you know, it was several WhatsApp messages the day before the race, you know, when, you know, just making sure that everything is set and the mindset is right. So yeah, the psychology is probably more important, particularly for those guys that have had big crashes. And I think you saw that in the World Champs final, that the difference between first and second was Rach just came out of that start hut possessed. And yeah, she messaged me after the race and said, I was prepared to crash. I wanted it. I wanted to win. I was prepared to crash and break my collarbone again, and I'll send it. And I think that's a winning mentality. That's incredible, you know, to come back from the injuries and just put your body on the line. And I think we saw that, and it, you know, that was why she put almost a 10-second gap into her competitors.
Yeah. You could see it in her run. It was, it was loose, but amazing to watch.
Yeah, and working with these guys, you know, so naive I am. Sometimes I'm like, look, could you just kind of come down a little bit, you know, on this run, especially when we were trying to get ready for last year's Worlds. I'm like, can you just take a bit more of a measured approach? And they're like, Nick, you know, if you do that, you then definitely will crash. But equally, you've got to go full out. You can't really measure it too much. It's all or nothing if you want to win.
Yeah. And you can get the athletes back on the bike pretty quickly with some, I don't know, good technology and good understanding and all that kind of stuff. But it seems to take a while for the mental piece, certainly, to come back to where it should be. I think, you know, G's taken a lot of stick from the internet warriors over the last season or so. You know, people saying he's done, and then came back and showed, you know, what he's capable of towards the end of this season.
So I think people don't appreciate that just because you're back on the bike, physically we can get you there, and also mentally we can get you there. But it takes time to... It's not the sort of sport where you can just go out and train all day, every day on those runs. It's so physically demanding. So, you know, G got back on the bike last year and came back from his dislocated hip. But you then have a winter where you've got to sort of go back and consolidate that work. And then you've got to get on the bike and kind of find your speed again. And talking to G throughout the season, you know, you're always looking at the results and asking, is your training going as you want it? Is there anything you want to change? And he's like, no, the speed is there. I can feel it. It's coming. You've got to love it when your internet warriors get on there. And you know, when I was competing, you used to get a lot of that. And I've got a quote from President Roosevelt, which basically is, it's not the critic who counts, it's the person that's in there actually doing it. So it's easy to sit from the sidelines and say what you should and shouldn't do, but unless you've done it, you should pipe down. And I think G, you know, I'm so pleased for him to see how his season has rounded off, you know, finding that speed. I think it was there probably a couple of races before, but he had a couple of technical issues and a mechanical, and then obviously the injury to the hand held him back a little bit. But you know, the last couple of rounds, he's proved that he's not done. He's still a force to be reckoned with.
Yeah, awesome to see. So if people are injured, are there any kind of tips or thoughts on how people can at least maintain some of their base fitness while they're working through that injury?
Yeah, so the riders get annoyed with me every time I say, oh, brilliant, this is an opportunity. An injury is an opportunity. Trying to convince G in the hospital bed that a dislocated hip was an opportunity was tough. but for him it was, you know, he had a grumbly shoulder. So it was like, well, we can sort your shoulder out whilst your hip's sorting itself out as well. So I would always look at, you know, you usually have the other limbs that are working. There's other ways that you can get on it. So even if you can't get on the bike, you could do single leg rowing or single arm rowing. You could do conditioning, single leg cycling. You know, I think there's always ways in which you can keep on with your conditioning, even training the uninjured side. There's research that will show that there's a crossover effect. So there's neural learning, so that by maintaining the strength gains in, say, your left side, the right side will get the adaptation. So there's really no excuse to keep it going. So physically, you can still train. Mentally, you know, it's just getting your head in the right space. Again, approaching it like an opportunity to work on other areas that are weaknesses. And then I think we also look at nutrition strategies. So nutrition plays a huge part in the healing process. And we have a couple of strategies that we put in place immediately when a rider suffers a significant injury, a break, and that's from work from a colleague who's worked with England Rugby, looking at how to best optimise performance. So, as soon as I get that call, we then usually put into practice a simple but effective nutrition strategy for them to make sure that they're as healthy as they can be going into the injury.
Interesting. Are you able to give any insight into that nutritional side of things? I know, so I've seen people with bone broth and things like that.
So that sort of stuff. So there's different ways you can do it, but basically looking at collagen. So you can now buy collagen shots, you can make your own collagen jellies, which G tried, but they ended up being more like rubber balls. We were on a training camp and you could actually bounce them pretty much the height of the house. So they weren't very tasty, but you can get commercially available ones. Rach is a big fan of bone broths. She loves a soup. It's kind of her go-to food. She likes to stay warm, so you can do it that way. We also look at protein intake is important for repair and regeneration, as well as anti-inflammatories in the early part of the healing process, and looking at things like your omega-3s, your fish oils, getting in there. So lots of colourful fruit and veg, lots of your healthy oils, protein, milk is also important for those, for that bone healing. So it's dead simple stuff, you know, a nutrition first approach. Doesn't have to be loads and loads of supplements, but just making sure that as soon as you can, you get it into you. And again, last year, G's dislocated hip. I was like, how's the nutrition going? This was sort of like day two or whatever. He's still in hospital. And he just sent me a photo of a cup of tea and some really manky looking toast. And he's like, yeah, nutrition's not really on point in this hospital up here. So again, it's important that you try and get that rectified as soon as possible.
Yeah. Okay. Interesting. And let's talk a little bit about, I guess, the athletes, but also for normal people. Yeah. Are there certain things that we can focus on in our riding or our training that can help reduce the likelihood of injuries? Because, I mean, G and Rachel, although they've had some bad injuries throughout the years, they seem to be able to handle some pretty massive crashes and walk away relatively unscathed. How can we approach that as normal humans and get somewhere near that?
So with all the athletes I've worked with in the past, you see that the better they are going into a injury, like in terms of the stronger, the fitter, the healthier they are going into that, the better they'll come out the other side. And there's actually research now looking through the NHS that shows that actually, rather than thinking about post-operative care, it's about pre-operative. So make sure the patient going in for any sort of surgical intervention is as healthy and as fit as possible, because the speed at which they'll return to normal levels of conditioning is much quicker. And that's why, like you say, you see these riders on the circuit take some big hits, and somehow 28 days later, Rachel's back racing. 58 days later, G's back racing. That's kind of superhuman, but it's also a testament to the condition that they were going into that. So the advice to the recreational rider is, you know, be as fit as you can. Spend the winter getting yourself fit and strong, and you'll know that, you know, I know from my own training, that if I've done some good work over the winter, when I get out onto the trails, it's easier. So I'm not hanging out my arse and blowing on a trail. And fatigue is linked with potential for injuries. So because your decision-making is impaired. So if I'm tired at the end of a two-hour XC trail and I've got one more single track run to do, you know, if I'm absolutely hanging, I'm going to make a poor decision. And that could be me going over the bars or into a tree. And that's the same for anybody, really. So the fitter you are going into the event, the better chance you have of coming out the other side. And then if something does happen, you do come off, you know, your body's better prepared to deal with it.
Yeah. And does mobility help in that? Like if your body can move properly as it's supposed to, can that help injury avoidance?
Yeah, so I think you might not be able to avoid the injury completely, but it may help reduce the severity of the injury. So if your body has, we talk about like a movement vocabulary, so if your body's used to getting into positions and ranges of movement and be strong in those ranges, when you do get thrown out or go a little bit sideways or find yourself in a position that's quite unusual, if your body's kind of been there already, you've got more chance of having a protective mechanism to support it. But if you experience a range of movement that you've never been in at speeds and loads that you've never experienced, then guess what? It's gonna not end particularly well. So yeah, I think, you know, imagine like worst case scenario positions that you may find yourself in, and you might want to build some of that work into your training programs.
Okay. So can things like yoga and Pilates and stuff like that help that side of things, or are you thinking more specific?
Yeah, I think certainly flexibility work like yoga, like Pilates, just simple flexibility work is beneficial, but I think it's making sure that you're also strong at the range. So you don't want to be, that's one of the things we have with Rachel is, you know, the amount of injuries that she's had through her upper body, you know, got lots of range in certain places, and we actually want to tighten that up a little bit and make sure that we're not as loose as so you've got some strength. So it's about getting flexibility, but then mobility is actually a combination of range and strength. So whatever range you access, make sure you're strong in that end point as well.
Okay, good. All right. So again, kind of focusing on the more normal people, are there any key activities or exercises that you think everyone should be doing on a regular basis?
It's difficult for real specifics, but for me, it's about your big compound exercises. So time's tight, and this is one of the things we talk to the riders about. You know, time on the bike this season has been most important for us. You're not actually going to win medals in the gym. Let's be honest. You know, the gym is to support the work that takes place out on the bike. So time on bike is precious, and therefore it means that whatever you do in the gym has to be functionally dense. You get the most out of it as possible. So if I can get you a session that's really functionally dense in 20 minutes and it takes another coach 60 minutes, that gives you another 40 minutes to do your bike-specific work. So I'm the better coach, right? Mm-hmm. So I think finding lifts that incorporate the major muscle groups is important. So squat-based, lunge-based patterns, hip-based exercises like glute bridges, stiff leg deadlifts are kind of our go-to exercises. And then upper body, it's your simple, you know, can you push up? Can you chin up? Can you shoulder press? Can you bent over row? You know, there's nothing particularly glamorous in terms of the exercises that we choose. It's big muscle groups. And then I guess it's then, so that's kind of like your force production. It's then figuring out, well, okay, so how do you absorb the force when you go into a big compression? What are the forces acting on the body and what strength do we need from that? And it may be that you just take the specific exercise and train it and load it in a slightly different manner. Core work, core is quite a nebulous term, but basically from your neck to your knees, all the way around your body, all of those muscles are important. And that will help with transfer of power through the bike and the pedals. And it also means that you're going to be more stable on the bike. You'll have a better riding position. So, you know, sometimes when we look at injuries for the upper body, it's actually that's not the shoulder is not the issue. It's the back, the core, the legs. And if you've got the supporting structures, it then puts you in a better position, which takes the strain off of other body parts. And I think that's something that we've looked at with the riders as well, is saying, look, you know, if someone's suffering something like muscle pump, yeah, it's no point doing loads of wrist exercises. That's just going to make it worse. Actually, it could be getting stronger through your legs and your core, which puts you in a better riding position that offloads the forearms. That will sort out your muscle pump. So I think that sometimes people kind of go route one to try and solve a problem, where usually it's not as simple as that.
So if you had very limited time and you had to focus on, like, you know, one key set of movements, is the core the place to start? I mean, I guess it is going to vary from person to person and their strength and weaknesses, but
yeah, I mean, I'd certainly put some sort of squat based activity in there, just because that will challenge the core in its own way. And we really like medicine ball type activities for working the core. So standing up, various medicine ball throws. We've got two or three routines that we use pre race and pre training. To really switch the lights on and get the riders ready to absorb some forces and produce forces rapidly. And that kind of ticks a lot of boxes. So we've got some simple routines that we use.
I think I've seen a little Red Bull video of you and Rachel with a medicine ball, actually.
Yeah, it might be when we were out at a training camp. Yeah, so yeah, that was something we tried to put in place quite early on, just to get some big payoff and try and ramp up the warm-up, because I think a lot of the warm-ups that I've seen, and I hold my hat up, I've not been to loads of races and I've not observed loads and loads of warm-ups, because we kind of stay in our lane and focus on what we're doing. But what I have seen is kind of fairly low level, and they're doing the right types of movements but no intensity, and you're going to get yourself ready to send a bike downhill really quickly. So we're quite aggressive with some of the work that we do in the pits, and some of the routines that we put together to get them ready for the demands of the riding.
Yeah. Okay. And you mentioned in passing, like the force absorption side of things,
yeah.
Like going through a compression and being able to handle that and changing the way you use a movement, maybe in the gym. Can you explain a little bit about how you would change an exercise to train for force absorption rather than force production?
Yeah, so you're probably going to overload the eccentric component. So let's say we're doing something like a bench press, because it's an easy example to look at. If you're doing a bench press, it's the lowering phase that you'd work on. So you can do it a number of ways. You can load it up really heavy and try and control that down, or you can actually add an external resistance. So what I would sometimes do is push on the bar. So they might have a load on the bar, and then I would push down on the bar as well, and basically that creates an overload for the eccentric strength, and that's what you would need when you're taking a hit, the ability to absorb the force so that the bars don't end up making an imprint on your chest. So you can do it either by slowing the movement down or by overloading it so that you have to then control the load down.
Okay, yeah, that makes sense. Cool. So any recommended reading for people that want to learn a bit more about strength and conditioning and maybe start putting together their own programs? I know, so you've written your own book, The Strength and Conditioning Bible.
Yeah, go on then. That's the one then. That's all you need.
That's it. Is it done? No.
I think, go on, shameless plug. I'm a terrible salesman. But that book was written specifically for general population. So it's not a science-heavy text. So it's kind of all the principles that I would apply with athletes that I work with. So the elements in that book are very similar to what we apply to the athletes. Get that book. That would be a good starting point. I think what we could probably do, if it's possible, I can pull a little reading list together, and if it's possible to add it into a link on the podcast, then we can do that.
Of course. Because
I'm terrible with names and references, but I can certainly pull out some of the books that are my go-to references and put those in.
Yeah. So we always put some show notes on our website, downtimepodcast.com, so people can go there. Yeah. So if you can send me a list of bits and pieces, we can definitely do that.
Yeah, definitely.
Cool. All right. That'd be awesome. Just on the strength and conditioning side of things, if people kind of are interested to go further and maybe want to get involved in the coaching side of things, or see that as their way to be involved in the sport, is there a particular pathway that they should follow? Any recommendations from you on that?
I think there are formal qualifications that you can take now, undergraduate and postgraduate degrees in strength and conditioning. I personally would suggest doing a broader sports science degree, undergraduate degree, and then do a postgraduate in strength and conditioning. I think people specialize way too early. And actually, when I work with a team, only a small fraction of my time is actually the strength and power development. The rest of my time is looking at energy system development. So that's the cardiovascular physiology. It's looking at nutrition. So I think my advice would be get a sports science qualification. And then you can decide during your 3 years if you want to specialize as strength and conditioning. And I think that makes you a more rounded practitioner. And I can go into a team and I can perform fitness tests. I can look at nutrition. I can cover the strength and power work. I can look at energy system development, GPS. There's lots of strategies that I can do because I've got a more broad base and also a lot of experience in different sports. And that would probably be, again, you have to probably make a decision. Some people really want to be the action sport coach, and that's great, but you then may limit yourself in terms of the number of athletes and the environment that you can work in. So my advice is work with as broad a range of athletes, old, young, male, female, able-bodied, disabled. Just get a broad knowledge, because I think that's definitely helped me when working with the downhillers. Rather, as I said at the top of the podcast, rather than it being a weakness, I see it as a strength. I come in with a fresh set of eyes and go, okay, cool, this is how you do it. I'm going to be the stupid kid at the back of the classroom asking all the dumb questions, because there's always, whenever you go to a sport, there's assumed knowledge. I'm like, okay, well, but why do you do that? Well, we've always done it that way. Okay, that's not necessarily the right answer. So and then try and find good mentors and good people to go and watch. Just go and watch sport, immerse yourself in it. I talk about doing field trips, and that was the first time I went and watched the guys train in Wales in the middle of winter, and it was freezing. They're like, why do you want to come, Nick? I was like, I don't know really, but I want to do a field trip, and I'm not sure what I'm going to get from this, but I know I'm going to get something from it. And you end up going and writing notes all day, and just seeing how they get on, how they load up in the morning back at HQ, to the drive out there, to then what their nutrition strategies are, to the weather conditions and how many runs they're doing. And like, I came away with a book full of notes from a simple field trip, but going into that field trip with no preconceived ideas of what to get from it. And I'd encourage anyone that wants to work with athletes or physical preparation, just go and watch all different types of sports, different people training. Do it yourself as well. Whilst I haven't gone downhill super quick, I have been out with Rach, and she's followed me, and I've followed her, and not for very long though, because she was soon out of sight. But again, by me going out there adds context to, okay, yeah, this is what we need to be doing. So yeah, just immerse yourself in the sport is the key.
Cool. Great advice. You mentioned a few times nutritional strategies. Can you tell us anything around nutritional strategies through a race week or a race weekend for downhill, or anything that would be useful for people to understand?
Yeah. So let me think. Yeah, I think, again, it's very individual of what each individual rider likes to take on board. Again, it's always a food first approach, is the key. So making sure that we've got protein, carbohydrate in the mix. Hydration is really important to the riders. We may then look at some other interventions. You might look at some caffeine before a race run just to increase alertness. But then for some riders, that's exactly what you don't want to do because they're already pumped already. So, it's a balancing act. But again, it doesn't have to be a huge amount of supplements. It's a sensible food-first approach, a balanced diet. Make sure that particularly post-race or post-ride, within a couple of hours, you are rehydrating, that you are getting on board some simple carbohydrates and protein, whether that's from a meat source or a fish source. And that's about as complicated as you need to get. Most people make it way too complex. Just get some real food in your body as quickly as you can and make sure you stay well hydrated.
Yeah, and hop in the ice bath.
Well, not if you're race, because she doesn't really like ice baths, but we've got some cool things that we use for recovery, which I won't go into, but are along those lines in terms of cooler materials that we can use.
Okay.
That aren't ice baths. Rach likes to stay warm.
But
muddy last year, loved to get in the lake as soon as a race was finished. So each to their own. And that's the key thing, is it's not a one size fits all. You have to, and even if the physiology, even if the science says that it works or it doesn't work, you know, if it says it works but the rider absolutely hates it, it's not going to be effective. So the rider has to have expectations and believe in something for it to be effective.
Mm-hmm.
And equally, if the science says there's no real effect, if the rider believes in it, you know, then use it, you know, why not? So, yeah. With all athletes that I've worked with, there are some pre-race and post-race rituals and probably more routines, but more importantly, rituals that they'll go through that you think, do you know what, that does absolutely nothing physiologically, but actually it works for you. So let's keep it in.
All right, cool. Let's talk a little bit about the future then. Mountain biking, especially downhill, still a very young sport in the grand scheme of things.
Yeah.
The strength and conditioning side of things was unspoken or didn't exist until fairly recently. I think actually, you know, the Athens were some of the first people to be quite open about the fact that they were working very hard off the bike and getting involved in the gym and that side of things. But clearly it's developing, it's changing. Do you think there's still room for, you know, significant improvements? And if so, what kind of areas do you see those in?
Yeah, massive scope for improvement. That's what excited me so much about coming into the team, that even with such an established team, huge room for improvement, you know, and I would imagine it's the same across all the teams. The sport is really in its infancy. And as you say, it's gone from a period where, you know, you just got on a bike and sent it to now, you know, the athletes introducing the idea of physical preparation and, you know, first of all, doing lots of road work and then getting into the gym, and it not being a cool thing to do because we're kind of cool, gnarly dudes that send it and do all these cool things. We don't want to train. But I think that's going to change. You're going to get generation of riders that come through that are athletes, first and foremost, that have chosen to ride downhill to express their athleticism. Mm-hmm. Whereas before, you've had riders that are just intuitive animals on the bike that have kind of started to backfill some of their weaknesses with physical preparation. But I think very quickly, you're going to get a new generation of riders that come through that are athletes first and foremost. And I think you will probably start to see changes in the courses as well that will align themselves with the more athletic individual. And some of those technical races may start to disappear. And it's just a straight out gunfight of the fittest, fastest person. So I think there's a huge amount that can be done. I think, you know, get over the fact that it's not cool. You need to do it. You need to be physically well prepared to be your best, not just for the race, but most importantly, the race week before and after to recover from it, to recover from injuries. I think recovery and regeneration is something that can be looked at massively, and significant improvements. Nutrition, definitely. I think that's a simple win to look at. And then I think no one's really got hold of wearable technology and looked at the interaction between the bike and the rider. We've looked at some stuff initially. We've flirted with that idea. I think it could be done better. So everyone looks at bike setup and gets super into what frame size and what pressure we're running at and what, you know, it's mad. But no one's actually looked at, okay, well, what's the interaction between the forces that have been generated by the bike and then how that transmits onto the rider. And some of the initial work that we did, it's interesting. It's really interesting to look at that and actually understand and get a blueprint, a fingerprint, if you like, of your rider and the course. So actually understand the course, understand the physical demands, and then prepare accordingly. So I think no one's even scratched the surface on that yet. And there's huge gains to be made there. And the technology that's available is becoming more and more accessible. So wearable tech, use of GPS units is one. I think use of VR goggles and VR technology, again, something that we've had discussions with previously, I think is an area that can be looked at for taking out some of the danger of training runs and actually replicating that and actually looking at head cam footage on VR goggles and immersive technology and actually doing it that way. It's never going to replace the riding, but actually it could help. You can stop it. You can look at decisions that are going to be made at certain line choice. So I think VR technology is really interesting. There's some good work going on out in Dublin, some of the universities out there. It's as a sports go, it's a toddler at the moment. You know, it's just learning to walk. And I think there are huge gains that can be made. If a team wants to grasp it and really have a go, really do it, it would require some investment, and it would require riders that are at points in their career where they can embrace all of that. But I think if someone wants to do it, they'll run with it and they will dominate.
Yeah, interesting. So, I mean, no offense to G and Rachel, but I guess they're towards the older end of the spectrum, certainly for G, of downhill racing. Do you think it would be younger riders that would kind of see the most benefits from this? Is it a long, you know, relatively long-term approach?
I think there's stuff that we've implemented over the last sort of 18 months, 2 years that have impacted positively on their riding. But yeah, I think if you had a fresh slate and if you had riders that were hungry to come in, and G and Rach are still hungry to win, clearly, as we've seen this season. So yeah. You know, make no bones about that. But I think, you know, if you could get the setup where a team invested heavily into that side of things, then yeah, you could take some younger riders and I think they could dominate significantly. Absolutely.
Yeah.
You know, all the focus is on the bikes, but there's one key component, and that's the person on the bike that's still got to get it down the mountain. And I think there's loads of gains that can be made.
Yeah,
and cool. I think that comes from looking at other sports as well. Look outside the action sports, look outside of motor. You know, sometimes motocross is like about as far as people start to look. There is a lot going on in sports that you think are completely unrelated. And I think that's where my experience has come in, that you can draw upon and implement into downhill.
Yeah, because so football and rugby are using kind of wearable tech quite heavily, like the players are all tracked and their movements and performance throughout training and throughout the events. Yeah,
you should know. You should be able to fingerprint training runs in the UK abroad. You should have a good idea of what each course, and of course it will change over the course of a race weekend, but you should be able to. You know, we do it in other sports. You know what the pitch conditions are going to be like. You have an idea of the some teams set up with a smaller pitch to condense it. You should know the anatomy of each race and actually not just subjectively, but you can put some numbers to that, not just numbers from the bike, but numbers from the rider. And I think if you start doing that, if you start looking at the interaction between the rider, what goes on physically with them, and match that to what you see in the gym, then you're going to get something really exciting.
So do you see almost the physical prep being different from venue to venue then? So athletes kind of tweaking their physiology, is that the right word? Physiology. throughout the season.
Absolutely. And that's what we do. You know, we look at each race, we look at what we think the race run time is going to be in a very sort of gross way. And we put together some cool simulation sessions that address that, you know, because some runs are going to be longer. Some runs are going to be more technical, more physically demanding. You can certainly look at that. And many of the World Cup events come round year on year, so you kind of know what you're going to get, broadly speaking. Obviously conditions can change over the course of the weekend, but yeah, you shouldn't just go in with a blanket level of fitness. You should be targeting each race specifically.
And can you, so you can actually kind of make changes to your physiology in relatively short periods of time then, in the time between a couple of races?
Yeah, I think some of the races that are back to back, it's more difficult, but certainly when you've got sometimes probably 4 or 5 weeks between, you can certainly start to tweak it. And equally, you can start to focus, you know, you start to see that rates came good towards the end of the season, you know, so there's strategies that you can do. It's not always about winning it on the first race.
Yeah. Cool. Interesting. Well, it's an exciting future for mountain biking. So
I think so. If you get the right people involved, it can be.
Awesome. Well, we're getting towards the end of our time, and probably towards the end of your battery. We got a few quick questions that we've asked everyone.
Yeah.
So I'm just going to whip through those real quick. The first one is, if our listeners had £100 to improve their performance, what would you recommend they go and spend it on?
To buy the strength and conditioning Bible. That'd give them £80 change. and I would invest in a good physical prep coach that's local to them. I think that would be good, because, you know, if you get a good one that understands physical preparation really well, that can make a significant impact. And I think we've seen that with some of the riders previous years that have been good riders and unfit, and then even a bang average coach has got hold of them, and all of a sudden they've become superstars. Well, it's just because they got fitter and more robust. So if you've got £80 left after you bought my book, get yourself a good strength and conditioning coach, physical prep coach, and there are some good ones around, and get them to write you a program for the season.
And any tips for knowing when you found a good one?
I would ask around. So I would do your due diligence and, you know, ask for recommendations, check them out, check out testimonials from people that really exist. So I'd like to think that if anyone wanted to work with me, they would come and see me, and I would refer them to athletes that I've worked with and show them case studies. And also, you need to test run them a little bit. It has to be the right fit. Three of us went for the job with the Athertons, all of us very capable of doing that, all of us technically very similar, but it has to be the right fit with the individuals. You have to have that connection. So yeah, do your homework.
Yeah, cool, good advice. So if you could wind back the clock yourself and have a sit down with yourself age 16, what advice would you give him?
I don't know, really. I'm not sure I'd change anything, because it's all added to the mix. Probably just back myself a little bit more. It's taken quite a long time when I started my career to actually have the confidence of the way that I deliver and the way that I coach. I was probably trying to be something I wasn't for many years. But I've found my style and my way of doing things now. And I guess that might just come with age. But yeah, if I had to say anything, it's just believe in yourself and back yourself a little bit more.
Good stuff. And then the last question, we normally do this around coaching from another rider, but I'm interested to hear, if there's a rider you want some coaching from, who would it be, and what would you want to learn? But also, if there was another strength and conditioning practitioner or sports scientist that you could work with and learn from, who would it be and why?
Rider, it would be Athy. They have threatened to get Dan to take me out and teach me how to ride a bike properly, which scares the bejesus out of me. But yeah, just being around him is incredible, just talking to him and his knowledge and understanding. So I guess if I really wanted to try and send it down a mountain really quickly, I'd want Athy in my ear telling me what to do. Strength and conditioning coaches, there's loads of good guys out there. I think, you know, I've got to tip my hat to Darren Roberts, who in terms of action sports has helped me massively to understand the sport. So it's always good. I was with him last night actually having a quick chat. It's always good to pick his brains on, you know, he's been in the sport for a long time, seen all of its development. So he's always someone that I go to for this particular sport. He's one of the guys in the UK.
Yeah. Cool. Good stuff. All right. If people want to find out a bit more about yourself, where's the best place for them to find you on the internet?
So nickgrantham.com is one of them. And then there's 0226.com, which is kind of like the businessy side. And then the one thing the Trek guys and the athletes did do was they upped my Instagram game. It's still pretty low end, but that was something that was very unusual to me when I started working with them. I tend to be a bit more in the shadows, but all of a sudden everything's getting instant. So I'm on Instagram as well. I'm sure people will be able to find me 0226 on there as well.
Awesome. All right. Well, we'll stick some links to those. And if you can send the reading list over as well, we'll put that in the show notes. And awesome. Thanks a lot for your time. Super interesting. Looking forward to seeing where it all goes over the next few years.
Perfect, Chris. Thanks for calling us.
Good stuff. Cheers, man.
Thanks a lot.
Well, that's it for our episode with Nick Grantham. I hope you enjoyed listening. If you did, then show your support for the podcast by heading to our web store and grabbing yourself a t-shirt. Head over to iTunes and leave us a review. And don't forget to subscribe so you get all of our future episodes delivered straight to your device. We'll have another great episode for you really soon. But until then, get out and ride.